We don't need that music yet. No.
No, that was me. Was that Matt or Matt?
Matt or Matt.
Okay, it was either Matt or Matt.
Okay. Dueling Matt. Yeah, we've got a couple of bats here.
We are back.
2 of 5. 2 of 5, yeah.
Not on the way.
You're having fun over there. We are back. This is the second hour of Tech Dis for Friday, April 29th, 2005, with the Asterix team party.
Hey, man, we should have just, you know, listened to the conversation. Let them have a party, you know, see what happens, you know?
Well, hopefully they had enough time to crack open another one and
yeah. So
we've been cracking open the Red Bulls. We're having a Digium all-nighter tonight. We're all going to code and work on different projects.
All right. Cool. Hey, that's my kind of crew. That's cool.
Yeah, we're pretty tight here.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know what it is about the geek community, but it just seems like most of the programmers and technical people tend to be night owls. They don't sleep. I don't know.
That's because everybody's trying to talk to you during the day.
Yeah.
It's hard to get anything done when you have to do work, you know?
I think there's some sort of chemical released by computer monitors that compels you to stay awake.
Ralph. Well, actually, Ralph is
in this case, it's the Red Bull.
Cool. My sister makes some sort of a drink. I don't remember what it is. She takes Red Bull and some sort of alcohol.
Vodka. No. It's a Jaeger bomb.
Yeah, Jaeger bomb.
Red Bull and Jägermeister.
Well, she introduced me to that the last time I visited my sister, and I love that stuff. That's good.
That is good.
You guys know way too much about that. But, you know, anything with vodka is great.
This is the asterisk alcohol party, you know.
Actually, there is a term. Like, Brian, for example, is a true astroholic. I'll tell a funny story on him here,
okay.
Which is that he actually bought this very old building, where the school, I think, is going to be, and teaching his courses. And the day they were moving the building, he was at AstroCon, so he didn't even get to see it because he was there giving a talk on Asterisk. And that's pretty hardcore.
I got the domain asterholic.org, and I don't know what I'm ever going to do with it, but I have to say that since I was first introduced to Asterisk, that's pretty much all I've been doing professionally, and it's been a very rewarding thing to spend my time with. I think Kevin would probably agree with that as well. I don't know how he got into it, but it's pretty addictive.
It's hard to get most people excited about telephones, but the people who do get excited about telephones get really,
really
excited.
Really?
Yep. Now, I kind of have a question that is probably not all that important, but it is sort of a odd curiosity for me. Years ago, in the analog days of phones, if you took a C-band satellite dish, pointed it at the proper satellite, and you took the output of the
transponder.
Yeah, basically, you took the output of the
satellite receiver.
I'm trying to remember. I think it was. I know you fed it into the antenna input of a general coverage shortwave
receiver. You used the video. Composite
video out, I believe. Yeah, and fed that into the antenna jack of a general coverage satellite receiver. If you were
no general coverage shortwave receiver.
Right, shortwave receiver. If you were tuned to the proper satellite, and you were then, you would get a bunch of, I think it was lower sideband audio from the telephone company from about...
You could hear a bunch of trunks.
Right. I think it was from around like 2 gigahertz up to about 8 gigahertz or something. I don't mean gigahertz, megahertz. They were very narrow channels, and basically they were being fed very similar to the cross-country microwave links, but in this case they were using a satellite for those links. A few of those things are still in existence, as I understood it, but they're basically, of course, now digital.
From what I understand, the only place that's doing it at all via satellite is Alaska.
I think that's probably true. There may be some emergency services that occasionally jump up there for certain brief periods of time. But I guess my curiosity would it be possible to easily get a piece of equipment to... that you could basically interface to listen to those calls, technically, do you think?
I don't know who's going to be able to answer that one.
Yeah, I mean, right now there are channel drivers for Asterisk that support the standard sound subsystems in Linux, first of all.
Right.
So if that's something you could feed into a full duplex sound card, you could tend to potentially do one single channel that way.
Wow.
There is also a driver for some sort of PCI radio card. I'm not sure exactly what card that driver's for.
That's the pilot telephony card is the, I think it's four ports of E&M, and it's designed to interface with radios. And Jim Dixon, a.k.a. Dude, is a guy that basically helped develop a lot of the architecture for the pseudo-TDM bus piece. And he's kind of gone off on the radio tangent where he's helped develop a bunch of code to support radios and keying and that kind of stuff all within Asterisk, so you can integrate radios and telephones. Mm-hmm. But the actual radio part doesn't take place within Asterisk. It just interfaces to standard radios. Not that I know anything about radios at all.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting you mention that, because someone in our chat, I think it was Eric a little while ago, said some people were using Asterisk somehow interfacing it with their ham radio repeaters. So, you know...
Right, well, that's probably using this card and using that network.
And what card is it called?
It's on the Zapata Telephony website, and it's the, I don't know what it's called.
It's on the what, telephony website?
Zapata Telephony. I'll type it in the channel.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, Linux People E.
Yep, that's our...
Got the link, right.
Okay, great. And one of the people in the Palm Questions was asking, I think it was, what is the, which Linux version works best with Asterisk?
Nah, that depends on who you ask.
Yeah, like Dianora would say BSD, that's what she would say.
So I personally use Fedora, and I believe I'm probably... the only technical person here at all that uses Fedora. Other people here use Debian, or my personal most hated distribution of all, Gentoo.
Which Dale
uses. Yeah, Dale uses Gentoo.
I use Slackware, if anybody remembers that one.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
We know somebody who's using
it. I guess the simple answer there is, if the distribution you install is stable on your hardware, that's good enough. Asterisk is not very distribution specific at all when it comes to Linux. It works on 2.0, I don't know if it works on 2.0 kernels, but it certainly works on distributions with 2.2, 2.4, and 2.6 kernels, modern and older C libraries, modern and older threading libraries. It seems to work just fine on just about any Linux distribution.
What have you got on that laptop, Dwayne?
What are you talking about?
What Linux have you got on the...
Well, I'm using an installed version of Nopix, which I think is based on Debian. I basically took Nopix, and then I did a hard drive install of it, so...
We do also support... Well, I shouldn't say we. Digium doesn't support, but there is support in the Asterisk source distribution for running on a number of BSD variants, including FreeBSD and OpenBSD, and we do have people running it as well on Mac OS X. And I believe there's even support in the source tree for running Solaris, although it doesn't get updated as often as the other platforms do. So there's definitely a number of options there. The biggest issue you're going to run into if you choose to run on a platform other than Linux is hardware support.
Mm-hmm.
The Digium branded hardware drivers are Linux only. There are some of them that have been ported to the BSD variants, but not all. And none of them have been successfully supported to Solaris or Mac OS X yet. So...
No, it's certainly definitely interesting stuff as far as How long, you say it's been worked on for about 4 years. How long, or 5 years,
actually,
6 years, I guess. How long has it actually been available to the public? I think the first I heard of it was maybe a year and a half ago, and obviously it was already pretty much in, you know, well in existence by then.
Yeah, it was actually, I released it in 1999, but it wasn't especially useful for most people until maybe around 2000, 2001.
So it's been around a number of years, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hear about it until maybe a year ago or something like that. So,
well, it's been amazing how much it's really picked up in the last 2 or 3 years. It's just been pretty incredible. I mean, last year we had, we didn't put it together, but a couple of consultants, Ali Johansson and Stephen
Sokol.
Sokol, thank you, decided that they wanted to have a conference on Asterisk. So they called us up and they said, hey, we're going to put together a conference just about Asterisk, and we think we're going to get 100 people to pay $400 to come to this conference. And we're like, yeah, we support you all the way. And as soon as they hung up, we were like, there is no way they're going to get 100 people to come to a conference. It's just about Asterisk, right? I mean, conferences are about whole topics. Well, as it turns out, they ended up getting almost 500 people to come to this conference about Asterisk in September. And now there's going to be another one in Madrid in June that we're going to.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's really incredible. And I mean, this one in Atlanta, I mean, they had people from 30 countries. There was a guy from Nigeria who had actually gotten his visa, bought his tickets and everything just to come and attend this conference about Asterisk. It was incredible.
Well, we have 51 people.
Oh, and don't make any jokes about the spam thing when you talk to people from Nigeria, by the way.
Yeah, they all want you to put your money in their bank accounts, right?
You'll get a very, very long explanation if you make any reference to that.
I think
and
we
just to
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What Mark was talking about there, my unless you need to take a break here, my first public exposure in terms of the Asterisk community, other than electronically, was only at the beginning of March when Mark invited me to come to San Jose and work in the Digium booth at the Vaughn conference that was there. And I don't remember what the actual numbers they ended up saying, but I believe Pulver said they had something over 6,000 attendees to the three-day conference that was there. And of all of the booths, I mean, we're talking booths from every major telephone equipment manufacturer and every major network equipment manufacturer and just everybody you've ever heard of in the telephony world. Every day, all day long, the Asterisk booth was by far the busiest of all of them. There were times you couldn't even move around in the booth. There were so many people there.
And it was also the largest booth, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah, it's the community involvement it is just phenomenal. I spent probably 2 hours on one day talking to representatives from the IT and telephony departments at three universities somewhere in the Midwest, I don't even remember the names of, who were all doing test deployments of Asterisk to try to solve problems with their existing phone systems, with the goal of being off of their existing phone systems sometime in the next few years. So that's some pretty serious stuff. I mean, this is no longer just hobbyists playing around with a cool open source product. It has really become a very serious tool.
Well, it's certainly, you know, to my way of thinking, I like both ends of it. I mean, I love the fact that it's deployable enough and scalable enough to go to any size somebody might want to do with it and make it, you know, a serious project for their, you know, business enterprise. But at the same time, it is something that the hobbyist can play with a relatively small outlay or virtually no outlay, just get a scrapped machine from somewhere and start playing. So, you know, it's so, and what I really love is the flexibility, you know, that you can do so many things. The stuff many of us only dreamed of doing 20 or 30 years ago, you know, is now possible on this little teeny box.
Well, and the thing is that the stuff that you dreamed about doing would require a room full of equipment to do it. I mean, that's
and $1 billion in capital.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Speaking of hardware, I think this question may have been asked before, but maybe they missed it, or maybe we need to put it in its simple terms. Stephanie's asking, what are the hardware requirements to run Asterisk besides a server box? And I think you may have answered that. Let's go ahead and do that again.
If you want to use DOS phones, that's all you need.
And DOS phones are just software-based phones, basically. You'd use like
they're programs that use your local sound card on your machine, and there are dozens of them out there for every platform.
And you,
probably not as stable as people would like to see them, although some of them are absolutely excellent. But if you, like my minimal configuration that we use here for our beginning students at school is a 166 Pentium laptop and a soft phone, and it's not super high quality, but if what you want to do is play, you can get into one of those for, under $100.
And we're talking, use your sound card, you can just plug in just a cheap, headset or a mic and a pair of headphones and like, basically a lot of the people that are on our group are already using Ventrilo and Skype, so the technology they have there, they're ready to go already, in terms of a sound card and a headphone and that sort of thing.
They don't need anything else but just get the server up and get it configured.
Right. And then as far as additional hardware goes, it would be entirely dictated by what you want to do with the system. As we discussed in the first hour, if you want to connect it to traditional telephone equipment, the Digium obviously makes a variety of interface hardware to be used to connect Asterisk to traditional telephone service, both analog and digital. There are, of course, also other products out there that either do that inside your PC or are Ethernet-connected devices that can be used to connect traditional telephone service to Asterisk, or actually any phone system for that matter, as well. So there's a great deal of variety out there. But just to talk about hardware requirements, this is kind of a natural segue into one of Brian's pet projects, which I'm sure he would love to talk about. So I'll let him go ahead and do that.
my current hot thing is to use a little Linksys WRT54GS. Mark and Kevin, this will be news to you, but I've coined a term for it. I call it a phone node, phonode. And it's a combination CPE for a network. That is, I can put in PPPoE or put in a wireless, they have a wireless interface on them, whatever. Well, the box is running embedded Asterisk. And in the latest CVS versions of Asterisk, one can actually take all of the configuration away from those configuration files and just simply point the configuration files at a SQL server. So I'm running a secure version of a SQL client on the WRT54, and as soon as you boot the client up, it finds its home SQL server, and at that point you plug in a telephone to it, and it's got full telephonic functionality that comes right out of the box, and the whole rig is less than $150, and it gives you your internet connectivity, firewall software, a switch for your local area network, a telephone server, and an IP phone. So I've actually talked to a couple of people from the FCC about this, and they, modulo the fact that no phone company really wants to take part in an experiment that would ultimately spell their own demise. Something like this in areas that don't currently have telephone service, $150 is way, way cheaper than what it would cost to string copper, fiber, or any other means of doing TDM-type telephony in a rural area. So we actually built our own phone network here at the college where we actually set aside an area code, and we have exchanges, and we have people running Astra servers that act as COs for those exchanges, and then we have customers, and they all run 100% on these little $75 WRT boxes.
That's pretty strange.
So it's pretty interesting to think, and down the road, I understand that there are some of these are going to come with actual telco, that is FXS and FXO ports on them, and of course the platform has been basically based on open source software from its earliest incarnation. It's Broadcom is the company that right now is doing the most with that. So it's all open source, and so it's a kind of a natural thing to think about at some point in the future that Asterisk would be part and parcel of all the distributions coming out on these little WRT-like devices. And the most attractive thing, of course, is the price point, that they're way under $100.
Now, are these things available fairly easily to work in any situation? Because I know that a lot of them had been previously locked to be used with a particular purveyor's equipment, and you couldn't get to the access page to reset anything.
No, I'm talking about actually taking what would be like a home wireless, you know, gateway that you would buy at Fry's or a Best Buy or something
A typical, like a router.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you put OpenWRT or one of the other, well, I use OpenWRT as the Linux distribution. Once you've got that on there, then you have iPackages, I think they're called, and basically there are iPackages for many, many, many different open source software products. So I started with that, and actually now I'm maintaining a version of the Astra CVS head that basically I build every couple of days, so all the latest features of Asterisk are available on a platform that is, you know, a commodity under $100 platform that's pretty easy to get your hands on, and people, you can play to your heart's content with something like that because you don't have much money tied up.
Okay.
The issue you brought up regarding the devices that are locked, those tend to be the devices that actually have the telephone ports in them, like Brian was mentioning. Those are the Linksys PAP2, which is a two-port telephone adapter. They also have varieties that are embedded into routers, and those are typically sold pre-configured for the Vonage service or the CallVantage service or one of the other major residential voice over IP providers.
Right.
And you're right, you purchase that device, and then 9 or 12 months later, or you decide not to use the service anymore, and you find out that the device never actually was yours. Even though you bought it, you can't use it except with their service.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that's going to play out. So far, most of those deals, you know, if you go into a Fry's Electronics or a Best Buy or Circuit City or wherever else that they sell those devices, the prices for those devices don't tend to be much less than the unlocked version. The user who's buying that device is not really getting that great a deal on the hardware itself that would justify it being locked. So I suspect that in the next couple of years, that's going to be forced. It's going to be forced to change.
Yep.
The consumers are going to force the providers to change that model.
Now, are there places fairly easily, say, on the net to figure out where to get unlocked versions of those? Because as I understand it, some of them have been out there and have pretty much rapidly disappeared. I guess the companies are pretty reluctant to make them readily available for sale.
Now, there is
a Canonical
site where things about VoIP are readable on the internet. I mean, the Canonical place is www.voip-info.org. And there are pages there, pages and pages, devoted to different kinds of VoIP hardware and discussing their characteristics and configuration guidelines and things like that. It's a tremendously useful site. It's actually the stop of first resort for me whenever somebody asks me a question that I can't answer.
Cool. Well, I certainly appreciate that, because that sounds like something to explore.
Yes.
I'll go ahead and type that in right now on that Wokey deal here, just in case somebody missed it.
But the issue you brought up with the unlocked hardware specifically refers to the Linksys hardware, and you're right. The unlocked Linksys devices.
Well, even the
agreement that the...
Even the Cisco ATA box we have is locked as well.
Okay, yeah, that's a Vonage provided.
That's correct.
Cisco ATA,
Byron, you want to get that?
Yep.
Yeah, correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
They will unlock it for you for a price.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's interesting to know, because
the ones that are not... Yeah.
What's that?
That are not locked at all are available, but they are... The agreements that the providers have that buy them from the distribution channel... say that they are not allowed to sell them except if they're bundled with service.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some deals out there where you can go buy the Linksys 2-port analog terminal adapter with a $10 prepaid account that you never refill. And then after it's expired and the box is yours and it's not locked. I mean, you know, you talk about the morality or legality of that all day, I suppose, but... the other issue that's going to affect that is Cisco has just announced that they are buying the other major manufacturer of analog terminal adapters that they didn't already own. So it will be very interesting to see how that shakes out in the next few months.
Now, we have a caller on the line. REC wanted to be involved in this. REC, are you there?
I am here.
All right, can you guys hear him?
Yep.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I'm the one that runs Dial-A-Stream. Actually, I've been running telephone entertainment lines for the past 20 years, and for the past 15 years or so, I've been running interactive touch-tone, interactive-type systems, mostly off of the Dialogic D41 platform. We used to run those back in the late 80s, early 90s, and we used AMX81 cards for conferencing. So as you could tell, it was pretty crude compared to a lot of the stuff today. You know, we got, you know, this I've been playing with Asterisk now for the past, oh, I don't know, 6 months or so. And I'll tell you, I'm addicted. It's very flexible to work with. I'm still trying to figure out a lot of it. But it's, you know, it's really good. I'm just like to get some of the conferencing working the way I used to like it many years ago. But, you know, those kinds of things take time.
We actually had I have a customer, in fact, probably one of the highest density conferencing solutions I know right now is that there's this guy that's got 10 PRIs in a single machine that people call into and they get to move from one conference room to another by pressing pound. And it's just a free service that he offers.
Mm-hmm.
And you might ask yourself, well, why would someone dedicate 10 PRIs to a free service for people to call in and, like, just press pound to move between silly conference
rooms?
For
those who don't know, I believe that's primary rate interface.
Well, you know, I kind of question, yeah. I mean, I've been questioning that since 1984 when I started running these crazy lines.
Well,
why am I paying for this?
Well, here's the deal. For him, he's a CLEC, right?
Uh-huh.
So he actually, since most of the calls originate from Bell's network, he gets reciprocal minutes even though they're local calls.
Yeah.
And so he actually gets to make a little bit of money by doing that.
I've heard of people doing that.
I mean,
that.
He's not going to be a millionaire, but he can make a little bit.
I've heard of people doing that.
He could
certainly
pay for the hardware,
know,
and the connectivity.
Yeah.
And you know, the cool thing is that if you do want to start some kind of a line like we have with Dial-A-Stream, it really doesn't take much. All I'm running is a broadband connection over here into the box, and it's running off of static IP. And I'm using one of the free SIP providers, and I'm also using another provider that will provide me with a phone number in the 360 area code at no charge. And there you go. I mean, that's all it takes to get
yep.
in. You know, it's not capable of placing any outgoing calls, but sure, I can do pretty good with the incoming calls over this. So
and
the reason you're able
to do that is the same thing that Mark was just referring to there. When you obtain a phone number from a competitive local exchange carrier, they're being paid for every minute they receive a call for you. So there's quite a few of them now where you can obtain, you know, what are essentially referred to as DIDs, direct inward dial numbers, from any numbering plan area code that you want. And in some cases, they cost as little as a few dollars a month with no usage charges because the provider is being paid to accept the calls for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you could run a service like that and conceivably have, you know, 500 phone numbers in the top 500 markets around the country that cost you, you know, I don't know, $1,000 a month to provide.
Oh,
and
yeah.
they're not even long-distance calls for your callers to call you.
I've considered doing stuff like that using DID numbers and, you know, setting up something in the major markets, bringing back the old REC from, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Let's see. A question in the IRC asked about the service that I use and if they fixed the DTMF problem. And apparently they have because it's working for me. So that's not been a problem. It's not been a problem for me. I've had some problems with DTMF to other Asterisk servers.
There are four methods for sending DTMF and SIP. Four different ways.
And for those for those of you on the radio right now, DTMF is a nice word for touch tone.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, he was just commenting, and that is something that we hear it's a frequent issue that comes up on our support IRC channel and mailing list, that people will have their SIP devices or their Asterisk server and their SIP provider not configured for the same DTMF delivery modes, or in some cases the provider's network is just not configured correctly at all and the DTMF is not even delivered to their Asterisk server. So there are definitely some occasional issues there. And primarily, as Mark was alluding to there, it's because there's so many options. When you're running a protocol, for example, like the EECS protocol that doesn't have any more than one way to deliver DTMF, if you get audio, you'll have DTMF too. So the bane of flexibility is that sometimes you'll have problems because of it.
Okay. I know that Byron has a couple of phone numbers for some fairly elaborate asterisk boxes around the country. Are there any systems set up for demoing the capabilities of asterisk that you know of? Or?
Well, I certainly could call into I could call into Dial-A-Stream. I could call into Bell's Mind PBX. I could call into Telefreak is a asterisk service as well. In fact, right now we're demonstrating the flexibility of asterisk just by being on this conference.
Good point.
Yeah. It's very versatile. By the way, is REC still on the phone or?
I'm still here.
Okay, cuz I was going to say I didn't hear any beep beep beeps yet, so.
Nope, I'm still here.
Cool. Yeah, REC actually has done something I've wanted to do for a while, and I've been sort of procrastinating because since REC has already done basically what I want, I haven't really put forth enough effort into doing it. But he was able to get some of the streams that we like listening to on a phone number, which is really cool. All we got to do now is figure out how come some of the streams won't work.
And that was the problems that we were talking about, where I was having the problems with MPG 123. Pretty much what would happen is that if you dial into certain streams, and if you want to hear one in action, you call the number and you listen to stream number 3, you'll hear the problem. But it's like you hear about like a half a second of audio and then it goes out. And I've been looking at these streams, and the only thing that I could find really that all these streams had in common was that they were all using tidal streaming, the ID3 tidal streaming. And, you know, I think it's a problem with MPG 123. And my understanding is MPG 123 is no longer supported.
I believe that's true. But it was released under GPL finally just before they stopped.
So hopefully somebody else will pick it up. And
well, and as I mentioned when we were discussing this earlier, even though Asterisk out of the box, as it were, defaults to using MPG 123 for that sort of thing, it is possible to use anything that can produce an 8,000 sample per second 16-bit signed linear mono audio stream.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, in the Asterisk distribution, there's a very small tool to play raw audio files off of the hard drive. I'm aware of someone out there who has managed to convince an XM radio receiving program to produce such a stream, so he can now listen to XM radio channels via his Asterisk server.
Oh, I bet XM would love that.
Yeah. Well, obviously you wouldn't be able to redistribute them, or you'd be seriously in violation of your agreement with them. But at least in his case, you know, he's using it for his own personal application, so he can do what he likes with it.
Well, that's
but the
good.
Point
that's
I was trying
cool.
to reach there is I'm sure that there are other MP3 decoding streaming applications out there that could be convinced to produce the correct audio stream. It's
mm-hmm.
just not something that people have really talked about doing very much yet.
Well, my next Asterisk project is probably going to be here. I've got a Sapura SPA 2000 that I'm going to try to interface in with it and try to get that thing working with it and have some fun with it. And maybe Byron can get his working.
That would be helpful.
Well, it would probably be helpful if I stopped using it under Windows. That would probably be the first thing.
Well, here's the interesting thing. You guys, when we mentioned this earlier, you were talking about maybe it was some sort of problem either with the OS or timing problems. I installed the same build of the Asterisk for Windows on my computer and had the exact same problem. And it's a different type of computer. I mean, it's a different machine. It's just, kind of weird that you'd have this exact same problem on a different machine.
What I think it probably is that you're saying the SIP protocol has trouble getting through net routers, and I am using SIPphone.com, and I am using the SIP protocol, so that could be the problem right there.
Well, you would have no audio typically if you have a NAT failure.
Ah, okay.
Right.
Usually it either works or it doesn't. It's not, you'll get signaling, like a typical SIP NAT failure is you call, a phone rings, you answer it, and there's either no audio or there's only audio in one direction.
Yeah, they hear you, but
right.
You can't hear them, or vice versa. Actually, I've been successful
exactly.
in getting my Sapura working over a NAT. The other thing, too, is that if I've got a soft phone installed on my company PC, and when I'm at work and I'm behind the company firewall, I'll get one-way audio, and that can get pretty annoying if I forget to turn off the soft phone.
File in the chat room says, ask if it's silence suppression. I don't know. Okay, I'm asking if it's silence suppression. I'm not sure what that means, but...
That would mean that it was that you weren't talking, and it was simply going very, very quiet when you weren't talking.
The problem Byron and I are having is it's just really choppy. It just sounds, it's...
Well, let me give you an example here of what it would sound like. If you're trying to talk to me on my Asterisk, it sounds like it would be very choppy. That's what it would sound like.
That's kind of
that sure sounds like
now.
Bandwidth problem.
That was pretty good.
Well, the thing is, and the weird thing is the menus work just fine. When I, it says, welcome to Byron's Asterisk experimental box. Press 1, 2, 3, 4 to get to Byron. Press 500 to get to Digium. And when I press 500, there's no problem. But when I press 1, 2, 3, 4, there's a big problem. The echo test works fine and everything.
And it's very, very predictable in terms of the audio
choppiness.
Problem. And I can't see, it's basically very rhythmic in terms of the screw up of the audio, and it just completely scrambles it so you can't understand it. And what I don't understand is there shouldn't be a bandwidth problem, at least not from here.
Is there a possibility that it's an interrupt problem? Are you using a sound card in any of this? Because interrupts are infamous for doing that.
Ah.
Yeah, I guess when somebody does call into my exchange, it rings on my computer, and I talk to them through my sound card, so...
See, if you have the interrupts aren't properly set up, this is an infamous problem for me anyway. It's exactly as you described. And once I got the different drivers for my sound card, I basically played around with the settings on it, and I found the sweet spot. All of a sudden, once the calls were crystal clear, and it turned out that was 100% the problem, that I had a network card and a sound card sharing the same interrupt.
Ah, wow. So I need to maybe figure out which interrupt the sound card is using and change
it. Well, certainly that would be a place where I would look for, because if you've got plenty of bandwidth, then your next problem or the next space you want to look in is on your own machine just to make sure, because I can on a machine that has a wireless card, if the wireless card is misconfigured, even though I've got a ton of bandwidth, you can't talk at all because the interrupts on the wireless card and the interrupts on the sound card are both the same, and it's just exactly like you just described it.
Okay. Yeah, this is,
one thing you two may find also is when you do get your SPA 2000 set up and you are now taking those calls on an analog phone off of that terminal adapter, so now all the audio is going in and out of your Asterisk server over the Ethernet instead of some of it going over the sound card, the problem may just disappear because of the same issue Brian's referring to there.
So maybe, in order to conduct an experiment, maybe what I should do is install Xlite or Free World Dial-Up Pulver Communicator or something on a different computer and have Asterisks forward the calls that go to 1, 2, 3, 4 to the other computer and see if the problem goes away.
Scott. I'd love to have some feedback on that. If you do wind up getting that to work, I'd love to hear it, just because that's a good thing to know to tell others, because the problem sounds exactly like what I fought with in that respect.
Well, if I can figure out how to make 1, 2, 3, 4 go to some other computer, I'll do that. I'm still trying to figure out how to, you know, write conf files and whatnot. What I might do is, if you want it, I can email you my conf file and see if you can look at it.
I'd be glad to help you with that a little bit. I wind up getting too many of these. I'm supposed to be working on a book right now, and it's a lot easier to get distracted helping people in the real world because there's a lot quicker feedback.
Yeah.
But it's not rocket science. I use X-Lite all the time. I'd be glad, if that's what you want to try to do, I'll be glad to try to help you with that.
Oh, I know what that's like, because I'm actually really involved in the podcasting world right now. I'm doing a podcast, and I did a tutorial on how to use iPod or 2.0 for blind people. And people kept asking me, before I put out a one-hour tutorial on how to use iPod or 2.0, how do I do this? How do I do that? And I just had to say, look, you're going to have to wait until the tutorial comes out, because if I spend all my time answering your questions, I'll never get the tutorial done. So after the tutorial came out, everybody's questions were answered, which was... I don't know if everybody's questions were answered, because now I've got more questions that were not answered in the tutorial. But at least the thing's done, so... Now I can spend my time helping people.
Good.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I'll be glad to help you with that. I somehow we need to... I'll get you my email, or you can post your email here to the wiki or the chat room or something. We can... It's not that much to worry about. It's easy.
There you go. I just posted it. Everybody knows it, so.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I'll write that down, and I'll be in touch then.
Awesome.
And I've got that reminds me of something that I'll have to get back to, but I've got a couple of questions that were emailed to me from Bob, who's one of the tech people at our local ISP. You guys here locally know who Bob is. He says, Dwayne, ask Mark and your guests what would be required in terms of hardware and software for an ISP like Logonix, that's our local ISP, to offer a VoIP to PSTN gateway so that customers like yourselves can make calls without having a phone line, just using VoIP over the internet connection to a server at Logonix's server backbone. So our friend here was like, what's involved in terms of putting it on an ISP for a VoIP to PSTN gateway?
It actually takes surprisingly little. Typically, an ITSP or an ISP would, if they're a dial-up ISP, they're already going to have plenty of PRI lines, and we could basically kind of hook into there and use their PRI lines to be able to handle telephone service. I mean, you're talking about at the central site, depending on how many lines there are. I mean, I guess I don't think I can talk prices specifically, but it's on the scale of what it takes to build an ISP, the amount that it takes to then be able to provide telephony services from a technical point of view after that is really not very much at all.
Okay.
It's not something someone wants to just pick up and do without doing a lot of testing, though, because you can get yourself into a lot of hot water really quick if you start promising this sort of thing.
Right.
But for example, one of the things that people, that Mark was kind of alluding to there, and that we have people doing quite often, for example, your ISP, if they are a dial-up ISP, may have a bank of PRI lines coming into, for example, Cisco AS5300 gateway, which is what they use to terminate their inbound modem calls. A number of people will do things like take a PC, put two four-port T1 PRI cards in it, take four of their incoming PRIs into one of the cards, and take the other four and hook them into the Cisco gateway. And they're basically putting asterisk in front of the Cisco gateway. So then when the calls come in, if they are numbers that are supposed to go to the modem pool, it just goes ahead and forwards the call to the modem pool. If they're numbers that are supposed to go elsewhere, it can deal with them in any way that asterisk can be configured to deal with them. So literally, as Mark was referring to there, you're looking at a decent PC that an ISP would want to rely on, some type of, you know, server caliber machine to put in their cabinets, and a small amount of hardware.
Well, it's interesting because it's
relatively easy to do.
Yeah, his next question was, what is minimal CPU RAM like? And this may be more of the the smaller project or hobbyist question, because he wants to, I think, put one at our church and maybe some other stuff. He says, will a Pentium 2 with 64 or 128 be usable, or is that too old?
Well, the issue that causes CPU consumption, there's really one huge issue that controls what your CPU consumption is, and that is, do the calls come into Asterisk and go out of Asterisk in the same format? If they do, then all it's doing is shuffling audio packets around, which doesn't really use very much CPU horsepower. But if, for example, you have a situation like your ISP where they're going to be connecting directly to the traditional telephone network, but their clients connecting over the IP connection to their server might be using some form of voice compression, then that box obviously has to do the compression and decompression to make the two sides of that call compatible with each other. And depending on the format they choose to use, some of those codecs are relatively cheap on the CPU side, and some of them are very expensive. To go back to Brian's example from a little bit ago, where he's running Asterisk on a Linksys WRT box, obviously that little box does not have a tremendous amount of CPU horsepower, and it has no floating point hardware at all. So if you try to run any of the complex codec translations, it will just fall over. You can't do it at all.
Yeah,
so,
in fact,
you know, a Pentium 2, you know, what would that be? That would probably be 350 or 400 megahertz, probably, with 64, 128 megabytes of RAM. That unit could certainly handle half a dozen calls that are just passing through it, that it's not having to translate without any problem at all.
I can attest to that. I have dozens of them out that are running on 350s, and you can even do a fair amount of transcoding on them. I mean, that for the hobbyist, there's no, I mean, a starter system wouldn't need to be much bigger than a 350. And I mean, like I said, I've even got some running on 166s that run okay. If you don't have to transcode. Transcoding
right.
is a different thing, and the more complex the codec, that is in general, the less bandwidth it uses, the more, no free lunches, the more it requires CPU cycles to do the transcoding then to get it into that format.
That makes sense. You're asking it to do more work. Now, are there hardware solutions that'll do the transcoding if somebody had one of those old boxes, they wanted to use it, and they had some need for doing the transcoding but wanted to hand that off to a card? Is that possible?
You want to handle that one, Mark?
I think that's a Mark question.
Boy, just put me on the spot there, why didn't you?
Sorry about that.
That's all right. There's not a lot of stuff to do that right now, although you can offload it to another machine. How about I just leave it at that?
That makes sense.
Yeah. If you use a device like the SPA-2000 that you're referring to or something comparable, then typically those devices will do transcoding for the number of ports that they have. So in a small application, for example, you could have the call come through the Asterisk server in a compressed form, be delivered out to the SPA-2000 still in its compressed form, and then be decompressed and delivered to an analog phone that's plugged directly into it. And that would give you the ability to use a relatively low horsepower machine, and even possibly handle a significant number of calls that way by just having a number of those devices out there. So that is one way to do it, and that's essentially what Mark was referring to. You're pushing the transcoding burden to another CPU somewhere else in the system.
Okay, that makes sense. I guess the other thing is, I'm assuming that what you would probably recommend is that somebody do the maximum amount of research on this stuff before they really get very heavily into doing a bunch of different configurations, or at least playing with the various scalability of configurations that you might want to do. But I am kind of curious if there are like flowcharts or plans for different levels of service that a person could just look at and say, okay, this is what I would need to do this, and this is what I might need if I want to add these features, in various price ranges so that a person could kind of get an idea without doing all of the major grunt work of completely understanding everything going on in the system. I mean, that's certainly something worth doing, but if you're trying to just get an idea of what's going on, you might want to look at something a little simpler. Is there anything like that that you know of?
There's a page on the wiki about provisioning that talks about exactly those issues.
Uh-huh.
By the wiki, we're talking about the VoIP Info wiki.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the VoIP-info...
.org.
.org, okay. I found that site a few months ago.
And that's the wiki.
Yeah, wikis are cool.
Yes, they are.
In fact, that kind of leads me to a question that I've been kind of holding off because I don't know how long it'll take and how we want to go about it. But, you know, we've talked about some of the hardware and some of the things you can do with it. But some of the people, including myself, want to learn how to set one up. Where's a great place to get the docs, the FAQs? I've even got an idea about the conf files. I would like to see someone. I'm not saying that hard work and learning the conf files and editing them is something that people, you know, people should do. But what about an idea of maybe a website where you go in and you plug in things you want to set up and maybe your specific information? You know, here's where I put in my DID or here's my free world dial-up information. And that webpage would generate the conf file you need. And yeah, they may still need some tweaking, but it would be less generic. It'd be a little closer to something that you could drop onto your site, and even if it still needs tweaking, it's closer to working. Does that sound like an idea someone might be able to implement at some point?
It sort of has been done, and
okay.
At least we tried it here at the school where I had a kid who was trying to do that by using a PHP script.
Right.
And what we found was, and I guess this is just my experience, your mileage may vary, was that in the completely generic examples, that's what it turned out to be, that it worked for completely trivial things, but then fell apart very quickly because there are so many different variables that fall into the picture that it becomes hard for the person who doesn't understand the various concepts that underlie asterisk. It becomes hard for them to even elucidate what it is they want to have done. If that makes any sense. We did try it, and it failed fairly spectacularly. People wound up needing to know the same amount that they had to do in order to get it to there was no free lunch in terms of getting to the configuration.
Because that's the thing that's, I think, holding a lot of us in our group back, is either we've started working with it and we've just got all these conf files and we don't know what the hell we're doing, or, you know, there's even some people that are like, you know what, I've heard of conf files, I don't even want to go there. I'm scared, I'm not going to mess with it. It would be nice to get, you know, answer these questions, drop in some information, and at least get the thing working. Yeah, you may need some tweaking, but it sounds like you guys tried that.
There are lots of resellers and stuff that specialize in doing just that. So, you know, even us here at Digium as well, I mean, we'll do installation and configuration for a customer that doesn't really want to get into it.
Basically,
so there's plenty of options.
Right, basically a turnkey kind of thing.
Right. And there are plenty of other people, too, that do it, too. It's not just us.
Yeah,
at the hobbyist level, you know, the one I mentioned before, the Asterisk at Home CD, contains a management tool called the Asterisk Management Portal, which is web-based. I think it's written in PHP. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially a way for you to have point and click, this is what I want to do, like what you're referring to. I want to add a new extension. Here's the extension number, etc. And when it's done, you can then see what it did in the configuration files, which allows you to then learn
exactly
what those things in the configuration files mean. Right.
Well, for
that's
short,
a SourceForge project, right?
I think it is, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it was in Pound Questions or somewhere. Someone put the address for that. I don't remember now where it was, but it was a SourceForge address for the Asterisk at Home. I guess falling short of my idea, where is a good place to start for learning how to put all this stuff together? And also, I want to get to the guy who is doing the course. I want to hear about that.
That's me.
Well, there is another website that we haven't mentioned yet. It's run by the community as well. In fact, it's managed by a gentleman who keeps telling me on IRC that he wants to hear his name on the radio, so I'll say his name now. His name is Leif Madsen, and it's www.asteriskdocs.org. And it's basically community-written documentation, which does cover the kinds of things that you're talking about. The documentation that comes with Asterisk is very, I suppose, what you would call bare metal documentation. It's, you know, really the guts of things. It's not conceptual or anything at that level. And what they're trying to do on AsteriskDocs.org is take it to that next level so that you can go there with a question at a higher level and have a chance of being able to find a solution to your problem. So that's another resource that's out there as well.
That'll one I'll check out, and I will also put in our show notes from our website, TomandDaryl.org. We have show notes, and I'll put that in there. That's something I'm going to have to check out.
It definitely sounds good.
The IRC chat room right now is being flooded with DNS information.
I looked it up when someone said that ByronLee.com wasn't resolvable, so I looked it up and pasted in the results. I'm not really trying to flood anybody.
Oh, no, it's okay. I actually just went to ByronLee.com, and it seems to be working, so.
Yeah, it's working from here.
Yeah, so Diane's just having a DNS problem.
And so what's this about learning about Asterisk and a... college course or something.
Well, we are at St. Joseph's College where I teach, which is in Rensselaer, Northwest Indiana. We actually it started out with a grant we got a couple of years ago from the Ball Foundation, which is from the Mason Jar people down in Muncie, Indiana.
Oh, my God.
And they enabled us to buy a whole bunch of voice over IP equipment and telecommunications equipment to put into our computer science lab here. And so we this year offered for the second time, and it was completely enrolled. We had 20-some kids in the class. Basically, we start out talking about speech and phonemes and the physics of sound, and then we talk about the telephone network, and then we talk about the digitization of sounds into the telephone network, and then we talk about IP networks, and then we talk about VoIP, and we do it all through Asterisk. It's a full semester credit course that we're offering here. It will be cycled beginning next year. We'll offer it every other year for college credit as part of our CS curriculum here.
And it's all bottled content when you're done.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to bottle it up. That's actually a project I'm working on right now as well, but it turns out to be that the wrapping is not quite as simple. I mean, it's easier to go in and teach a class every day than it is to write a book about what you're doing in that class. I can attest to that with 100% certainty.
Well, as I say, it certainly, I was kind of making a joke there because of the company involved, since they were always good at home canning supplies over the years.
Yep. Well, I'm calling the subtitle of the book is Do-It-Yourself Telephony Using Open Source Tools.
Cool.
And because there are some people doing some pretty infrastructural enterprise things with Asterisk, and that is one of the big advantages of it, is that you can run a little tiny server that's got one phone, or you can run a great big rack of servers that are all working to switch thousands of calls, and the same software is running underneath both of them.
Wow. It certainly sounds good. I don't know if it's if we should let people go or what's happening here, but I know it's definitely hitting the top of the hour pretty quick. So we'll have to decide what's happening next.
Yeah, can you...
Yeah, my little...
I don't know what you guys' plans. How much longer can you guys stay with us?
Well, eventually I've got to actually get back to programming and stuff.
That makes sense.
Well, let's do IDs, and then we can maybe take a couple more questions, and then you guys can give, you know, any information you want to give before you go.
Yeah, the address to that webcam that we're going to slash dot. And,
Sure. I'll give that to you guys as soon as the call's over, because I'm sure.
Cool.
Yeah, actually, you know, it almost would be interesting to see what would happen if we gave it out first, and we could see, like, how badly the audio breaks up.
That way, if you guys do want to go, then we can sort of test it. You know, wait until the call gets really bad, and then we'll end the call.
We only have a half a T1 here, by the way.
Only half a T1? Oh, my.
Yeah. It's kind of ironic, I suppose. At least a half a T1 for data. We use the rest for voice, but it's actually separated out.
Why am I suddenly reminded of...
It probably won't last long.
Why am I suddenly reminded of Monty Python now? You know, Eric, the half a T1. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
Well, Daryl, if you want to roll the IDs, we'll get our IDs out of the way.
I wonder if Dale just fell asleep. Dale, wake up!
That's right.
Time to run the IDs! IDs, man, run them.
Am I supposed to run the IDs?
Yes.
Oh, okay, I can do that. Wake me up when it's time to run the IDs, would you please?
Oh, that's funny. All right.
Like I said, it's hard to get most people excited about telephones.
Yeah. I'm right here.
Right.
I'm hanging on every word.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying. I can't get the damn... Sorry, hold on.
You're listening to WTND LP Macomb. See, this is what we call the dry read of IDs. WTND LP Macomb, the Wookiee Satellite Radio Network, Radio Free Dish Nuts, and all the wonderful affiliates that...